This is your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. Our topic is estate planning. We're focusing on the importance of advance directives. And also, what do you do when someone you love won't create an advance directive? My guests are Peter Stern and John Martin, specialists in estate planning, trust, and probate law, certified by the California Board of Legal Specialization. Mr. Stern's office is in Palo Alto. Mr. Martin's office is in Menlo Park. My third guest is California Superior Court Judge Eugene Hyman, retired, who spent quite some time as a judge on the Superior Court in Santa Clara County doing probate. And so we're going to talk about something that I think a lot of you are not even aware of. This segment of Your Legal Rights is made possible by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar, which certifies specialization in 11 fields of law, the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, and the National Board of Trial Advocacy. And I want to welcome you, Peter. You're by phone, but I know you're going to sound like you're in the studio here. And we've got John here, and we've got Judge Hyman here. And Peter, let me turn to you initially. What is and why should one have an advance care directive?
Well, Chuck, an advance care directive combines two things under California law. It is an advance directive with regard to what conditions a person wants to have apply to their health care when they can't make decisions themselves. And it's also a power of attorney in which the individual nominates someone to be the attorney in fact. That's a fancy legal term for the agent the person selects to make medical decisions in the future. By the way, powers of attorney for health care and advance directive can come into effect either on signature or in the future when the principal has lost the ability to make decisions him or herself. And most documents today will combine those two functions, the appointment of the agent and the setting out of what the wishes are of the individual with regard to healthcare decision making.
But this I'm sorry, Peter, go ahead, pardon me.
Well, I just want to finish. You said, and why should one have one?
Right.
Well, the obvious answer there is to have an indication, give an indication to the people you want to be responsible for your health care in the future as to what you want, so that when that time comes, when you can't make these decisions on your own, someone's appointed to make them for you, and you're going to have the kind of end of life that you think is appropriate.
Let me mention some information to all of you that you might want to do some research on your own, and you might want to, during the course of this program, take some notes, because there's some very important information for you if you're not familiar with this at all and you want to do some personal looking and studying, etc. The California Medical Association has an advance directive form. You can find that by Googling California Medical Association. Judge Hyman brought to my attention this whole subject some months ago. Harvard Medical School has some very important information on its website, which is www.health.harvard.edu. There is a report entitled Advanced Care Planning Report, which is available that you can get if you want. Also, on that website, you will find a four-page document, which is a guide to advance directives. It's, interestingly enough, it's form number 2, Health Decisions Worksheet, and it's something that you might want to take a look at. It's a four-page document that you can review, and all you need to do, if you didn't get the website, is Google Harvard Medical School, look for Advanced Health Directive, and you'll find this. Again, the website is www.health.harvard.edu. Judge Hyman, you brought this to my attention some months ago because Harvard had, in one of its documents that it had prepared, the title, What Do You Do? And this is how it's posed. When someone you love won't create an advance directive, what do you do? Now, you brought this to my attention, and why?
Well, because I'm fortunate. The time that I was in probate, I never had contested hearings over any of these issues. But I did have situations where people did not have family members that were involved with them at the end of life, and the public guardian was appointed to take care of their medical and financial needs. And the way in which they'd come in front of me is that they were being treated usually at Valley Medical Center in San Jose, and they had a terminal disease, and the medical professionals were of the opinion that this person needed to just have palliative care and that everything else needed to cease, that it was just prolonging a miserable end-of-life decision. So when that would happen, and it happened more than you would think, then our protocol, and every county has sort of a different way of doing this, but our protocol was to appoint the public defender and then to schedule a hearing as quickly as possible. The public defender would see whether or not they could locate through records with the public guardian, and the public guardian was very forthcoming in terms of trying to work with the public defender, in terms of finding next of kin, someone that the public defender could talk to get a sense, if possible, in terms of what would this person want to do, because they didn't have a health care directive, and this kind of a terminal life situation. Well, fortunately, in the time that I was there, I never had a contested hearing. What would usually happen is the public defender either found someone to talk to, and they said that the patient would definitely not want to be prolonged on life care if they had a terminal disease, and it was inevitable that, you know, that there was nothing that could be medically done to prolong a quality of life. So in which case they'd stipulate to the request of the public guardian through county council, or they weren't able to locate someone, in which case they would just submit it and I would make the decision based upon the evidence that I had. And the evidence that I had had to do with medical professionals who would describe the problem that the patient had that was terminal. And in all of those situations, I granted their request to remove everything but palliative care. Before I forget, I just want to go back to something that Peter said. And I agree with everything that he said, and I think he did a very good job in terms of defining this. With respect to the question of when the document should be effective, I personally have a preference for it being immediately effective, because if you have a situation where it's effective upon the statement of a doctor that says the person is now in a state where this should be effective, then you have to find a doctor that says that. And sometimes doctors are a little bit skittish about saying that a person is in a certain state for certain kinds of legal events to take place. They might be concerned about legal action against them for medical malpractice of some form. So basically, I'm of the opinion that these kinds of documents should be effective immediately. That requires, of course, that you have confidence in the people that you nominate for this position, and you shouldn't be nominating someone that you don't trust 100%. Now, getting back to the title of tonight's program in terms of what do you do when someone doesn't want to create an advance directive, I went through this myself in terms of my mother. She was willing to discuss this, but in terms of how to discuss this in a way that makes the most sense, there's a great card game on the website gowish.org.
W-I-S-H.
G-O-wish.org.
Yeah, go, G-O-W-I-S-H. Is that one word? Or
one word one on word. The website.
Okay.
.org.
All right.
And they even have, you can look at the website, you can actually look at the cards. If you want to purchase it, that's great. If you don't, that's okay. And it's a fundraiser for this organization, and it really made it easier for my ability to be able to talk to my mom and to find out what she wanted. And it made it, all things considered, a relatively painless experience. So I highly recommend this as a resource for starting the conversation. This is a difficult conversation, but I think it's one that has to be had. As an aside, in all candor, I did not have a healthcare directive or any trust state documents until I went into probate. And when I saw the kinds of litigation that I was dealing with, then that was very reaffirming that I needed to do something and do something quickly.
John, let me ask you this. If someone does not have an advance care directive, and let's say they, for example, are going to have a serious operation, what potentially, how would you deal with that? Or what would you recommend?
Right, absolutely.
What could go wrong?
A lot of things could go wrong. In fact, Judge Hyman brought up the situation where there's no objections. What if the family members come around, or conservator, that's a person who's appointed by the court who can make decisions for this person. What if there's objections?
Yeah.
What if people disagree?
Yeah. Family objections, right.
And so there's a few cases. Many of us are familiar with the national case, Terry Schiavo, not a California case, but gripped the national attention because here's this young woman, a beautiful young woman who had a brain. Her brain was never going to regain functioning, her doctor said, in a persistent vegetative state. And many in her family said, no, don't remove the feeding tube. Her husband said, yes, you know, she would want the feeding tube.
He said, yes, remove it, yeah.
And so in that case, you can see that an advanced health care directive, had it been executed, we would have had a clear statement one way or the other, and that would have eliminated a lot of the doubt and uncertainty that the family members had. And what about in California? Of course, in California, we do have a provision in the probate code that allows a conservator to withdraw nutrition and hydration for a person who's unconscious and in a persistent vegetative state, I should say, or in a persistent vegetative state. But what about the situation where somebody is conscious, but they no longer have the ability to express their health care wishes? And you could conceive of a situation like that. That was what happened to Robert Wendland in the 90s. He actually had a car accident and was unable to express his health care wishes, but he was conscious. And so his wife petitioned the court and said, well, I'd like to be able to withdraw nutrition and hydration. And in fact, he had said to his wife and several others that his father-in-law, who had been in a similar situation, that if he were ever in that situation, he wouldn't want to live like that, where he couldn't express his own wishes. So he had made these oral statements. And that case actually went up all the way to the California Supreme Court that said that oral statements regarding his wishes to withdraw treatment were not clear and convincing evidence that was sufficient to authorize the withdrawal of a feeding tube. The court was careful to say, well, this is limited just to the situation where a person is conscious, but they have the inability to express their wishes. Of course, would have been completely dealt with had he executed a healthcare directive saying, well, if I'm in a situation like this, where maybe the burdens of treatment outweigh the expected benefits because there's no possibility that I'm ever going to have a meaningful life, and he can express, or she could have expressed in a directive what that meant for her or him, then the treatment could have been withdrawn in that case.
Peter, let me come back to you for a minute on this. One of the things that I think you're very concerned about is arbitration clauses. Could you talk a little bit about that in terms of advance directives?
Yes, Chuck. What happens in both general durable powers of attorney and these are powers of attorney for financial decision-making and for healthcare decision-making, often what happens is an agent is the person who ends up signing somebody in. So you have a stroke, you're taken over to a neighborhood hospital, and then you're released to a nursing home, and you're still not at all competent. The only person who can sign you in to the nursing home or the residential care facility is your agent under a power of attorney. Now, the reason arbitration comes up is that it takes away the ability of the individual to file a lawsuit directly against the a nursing home or a residential care facility that may have done bad things to the person, caused premature death, etc. And so we advocate that people not sign arbitration agreements when they go into these facilities.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you sign in under a power of attorney, and the power of attorney the power of attorney expressly prohibits the signing of an arbitration agreement, consider that when you're going into a facility, you're looking at an inch-thick stack of documents that you sign.
Yeah.
You initial here, you sign there. You're under stress. Your loved one is in a coma, perhaps. and you don't know what's going on, and so you do whatever the facility puts in front of you. Then it turns out something bad happens a year later, and if you've signed an arbitration agreement under the power of attorney that specifically prohibits you from signing an arbitration agreement, then the arbitration agreement is void, and you can escape arbitration and can bring a lawsuit. That's a fairly long-winded explanation of why I'm very attentive to what goes into a power of attorney, either for asset management or healthcare, where it might be used to admit someone to a facility. That's why we don't want people to sign arbitration agreements.
Would you also do this, Peter, and then I want to give a little bit more information to everyone about what important things also are coming up. POLST, P-O-L-S-T, the Physician's Order for Life-Sustaining Treatment. What is that, and why should someone seriously consider that?
Well, this is a document that has a somewhat higher level of importance than a healthcare directive, because it's actually signed by a medical medical professional, as well as by the agent or the individual, and it states what kind of medical care that person wants if one is in a terminal condition. And it, right away, it can say, "I don't want to have I don't want to be resuscitated. I don't want to have tube feeding." And it's signed as an order by the doctor. Often, people are encouraged to sign a POLST when they go into an institution which can be as low a level as a residential care facility, and a nursing home would be a higher level, and that can tie the hands of the individual at a later time. We had a terrible case in Redwood City where the facility and even the medical institution that where the person had gone for treatment insisted that the POLST in place was the only document that person could sign. They deemed the person not to have the ability to understand medical decision-making and refused to allow the person to revoke a POLST that said resuscitation, no heroic means should I become ill. Mm. And we've had quite a fight with the institution about that. So one has to watch out for being encouraged to sign a POLST, perhaps prematurely. Under normal conditions, the POLST can be very valuable because it makes sure that your wishes can be respected, but one has to watch out for premature POLSTs.
But that of course, is in addition to an advanced directive, is it not?
That's correct. And
okay.
If the POLST is signed later, yeah, it can supersede the healthcare directive.
Let me give some information to all of you. If you're listening to the live program, and we're doing this on Wednesday, June 21st, in just a few minutes I'll invite you, if you'd like to call in with a question, comment, to call. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255, wherever you may be listening to this program. Also, I want you to know that our next monthly Call a Lawyer Night is next week, Wednesday, June 28th at 7 p.m. This is our monthly. We do this every month. When you can talk with an attorney off the air, you might want to jot down the phone number. Whether you listen to the live program or not, if you've heard this, you can join us by calling in at 7 p.m. next Wednesday, June 28th at 1-800-525-9917, 1-800-525-9917. And one other thing, and this is a very interesting coincidence, Joanne Marr, who works with me on the program, and we've been working together for several years, has been producing a series of feature reports this past year on end-of-life care. You may be interested in this. Death Goes Public is the next report that's part of Joanne's End of Life radio series. Death Goes Public reports on the thousands. This is very interesting, everybody. I didn't even know about this myself. Reports on the thousands of open conversations taking place in the Bay Area and around the world at death cafes and death over dinner events. For most of the last century, death has been a taboo topic. I guess most of us don't like to talk about death. If the subject was avoided and not publicly discussed, the deafening silence around death is starting to change now, and Death Goes Public was broadcast earlier today on Cross Currents at KLW. The report is archived in case you want to listen to it on the KLW website, which is www.kalw.org, or on Joanne's website, which is endofliferadio.org, endofliferadio.org, all one word. So that's something that you might want to listen to if you like. And this entire program, by the way, I want you to know, is available as a podcast, the full hour, at www.klw.org/subscribe. That'll be available tomorrow if you want. Now, we have a number of things that I'd like to try to talk about if we can. What if someone wants the plug to be pulled, that is life-sustaining, and someone wants to pull the plug? John, what would you say? And you don't have an advanced care directive.
Right. Well, first of all, there may not be any plug to be pulled.
Well, that may be.
But, right, you have the right as a person, if you're competent, and you're making your own healthcare decisions, you have the right to say, I consent to healthcare treatment. I'd like to continue getting nutrition and hydration. I'd like to continue having drugs. I'd like to have that operation, et cetera. And to the same extent, a person who's incompetent can make those decisions, but they have to document it while they're competent. And so that's just their decision-making being made in a document and then being carried out. That's what the Advanced Healthcare Directive
is all
about.
What if the person who has entered into and has signed an Advanced Health Directive says, I do not want to have life-sustaining treatment? And family members, whether it's the spouse of the person or the children, say, no, we want you to continue to sustain our father's or our mother's life. John, how would you deal with that?
Well, if the healthcare directive makes a clear statement that no, it will be withdrawn under these circumstances, that's the wish of the principal. And so the provisions of the healthcare directive can be enforced even over the objections of other family members.
And vice versa. If the healthcare directive says, I do want life-sustaining,
yes,
but the family members say, oh, no, we don't want our father, our mother, or whoever it is to suffer. We want you to pull the plug.
That's correct. It's the wishes of the person who's writing the document, and that's a great point. It's not always just withdrawal. It's also, when do I want to consent? When do I want to continue? I have a lot of clients that say, actually, I'd rather continue life-sustaining treatment as long as possible. I don't want it to be overbroad. That's perfectly acceptable. It has to do with the wishes of the person, and if they're unclear as to what some language might do or not do, I encourage them to sit down with their doctor, look over, and I will give my clients the actual language that goes in the directive. And I say, you know, I have clients that are doctors. This is what they say. But maybe you'd like to talk to your own physician and talk through your condition, talk through different issues that might come up. Another thing, Chuck, too, that happens is after somebody's death. You know, we've been talking about what happens while you're alive. What about disputes among family members after death? I had a situation where client's mother passed away. Half of her family members were of one religion. The other half was another religion, and they disputed where they'd like to dispose of remains. Healthcare directives can actually provide instructions on that as well.
So it can be effective after death.
That's right. It's also effective after your death. And if you haven't put that statement in a healthcare directive, how would anyone know?
Yeah.
Well, they'd have to rely upon maybe your oral statements, but that's very easy for family members to dispute.
Peter, let me ask you this. When let's say you've got family members who are there and someone is in the process of nominating someone or more persons for an advanced care directive, what is your feeling about having more than one person designated in the advanced health care directive?
Well, this is you could have co-agents, and sometimes people virtually insist on that. And they say, I don't want to treat any one of my children differently than the other. And this can extend to more than two people, I hate to say it.
Yeah.
And it can be a mess. So I go along with what Judge Hyman has commented on earlier, that it's really better if you have just one person at a time. On the other hand, sometimes what I'll do is say that I appoint my agents to act either together or individually if they cannot be together, where the person really wants the two people to be there, but if it's not possible, said, well, either one can act if the other is not there. Now, the problem comes up when they don't agree, and that can be...
That's what I'm concerned about, awful. Yeah.
Yeah, and so what, you know, if I can't create, you can't know in advance exactly what's going to happen, which is why you're often better off only having one person act at a time. But I haven't had that many conflicts. I haven't had the situation that John had where we had two halves of the family going at it from different perspectives. That has not occurred in my own practice. So I would say you're better off if you have one at a time. I can have co-agents. I've done it with co-agents, and we haven't had a total catastrophe yet.
Although we're keeping our fingers crossed, huh?
We are.
All right. John, let me come back to you. If someone is terminal, and let's say there is no advanced care directive that is dealing with this, could you, and you go into, this person goes into the hospital, what might happen? I know there's a practice of perhaps some hospitals giving a patient who is terminal morphine. Would you briefly talk about that?
I can talk about the morphine. Let me just say what would happen if they go into the hospital. They're terminal. They have the ability to potentially consent as to healthcare treatment initially. And so they can say, I'd like to have this morphine. I would not like to have it. So initially they can say that. They also have the ability to appoint a healthcare surrogate if they don't have a healthcare directive. In fact, even if they do have a directive, they can still override it temporarily by saying, I'd like to appoint so-and-so to make healthcare decisions if I no longer can. And that will last for the duration of their hospital stay or 60 days, whichever is shorter. So there's a major drawback, of course, of that provision in the probate code in that, well, it will only last for the duration of this particular condition or 60 days. Or the law does allow for a family member to continue making decisions for that person. And if they've expressed their wish to the family member that I'd like to have morphine, I'd like to have pain-killing drugs, that family member can consent on their behalf. Of course, the issue becomes what if there's a dispute among family members? And that could be something that's litigated, typically not over something like morphine.
All right. I want to give you an opportunity to call in. Ask a question, make a comment, perhaps have a chance to talk with my guests. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. If you are looking, by the way, we're talking with two of my guests who are certified specialists in estate planning, trust, and probate law, certified by the California Board of Legal Specialization. They've had to jump a number of hoops, take more than one bar exam to do this, and the California Board of Legal Specialization has 11 specialties. If you feel you need an attorney in one of any of the 11 specialties, let me just give you the website and so that you have that for the future. I hope you don't need it, but it's www.calbar.ca.gov, and go to the upper left of your computer screen to Legal Specialist. Click that on for your county and any one of the specialties. Support for KLW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The San Francisco Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation in both San Francisco and Marin County. For a referral to a lawyer or the Bay Area Mediation Services Program of the San Francisco Bar, call 415-989-1616, 415-989-1616. If you are in San Mateo County, the San Mateo County Bar Association also has a lawyer referral service. That's 650-369-4149, 650-369-4149. Nearly every county in California has a lawyer referral service, a bar association, and a lawyer referral service. You can call your own, obviously, during normal business hours. Tell them what the problem is. They'll do their best to find an experienced attorney to have a half an hour consultation with you. With minor exception, for a half an hour consultation throughout California, you'll be paying somewhere between $25 to $35. That money does not go to the attorney. It goes to the lawyer referral service to keep it going. It's a great consumer service, and I highly recommend it if you need it. I hope you don't, but it's there if you want it. My guests are, and by the way, if you've tuned in a little bit late, this is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. We're doing this program live on Wednesday evening, June 21st. Again, the toll-free number. Don't be bashful, and please, if you do have a question or a comment or some concern about whatever it may, area it may be in estate planning, you don't have to focus just on advance directives or pulse, etc. The toll-free number, 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. My guests are as follows: California Superior Court Judge Eugene Hyman, retired. Judge Hyman was on the Santa Clara County Superior Court for what, Gene, 20-some-odd years?
20 years,
and also as part of his duties at one point during that period of time, he was the probate judge. My other guests are John Martin and Peter Stern. They're specialists in estate planning, trust, and probate law, certified by the California Board of Legal Specialization. Mr. Stern's office is in Palo Alto, and Mr. Martin's office is in Menlo Park. So I hope you will take advantage of the fact that I have these guests here to talk with you. Additional funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Family Law Section of the State Bar, the Trust and Estate Section of the State Bar, the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar, the California Applicants Attorneys Association, and the San Mateo County Bar Association. So that's who we've got. So I hope you will take advantage. Here is a question that was brought into the studio. Whereas a family used to have use of a, and I'm not familiar with this, quote, third-party trust, end quotes, for a disabled patient, we understand that there is now a, quote, special needs trust, end quotes, for the direct use by the patient. Can we explain how the, quote, special needs, end quotes, compares with the, quote, third-party, end quotes, option? Peter, I'm going to throw that one to you.
Thank you, Chuck. Well, first of all, you know, a third-party trust is a trust set up by an individual to benefit another individual.
Okay.
The money that goes into that trust comes from the first person for the benefit of the third person, and the money does not belong to the third person. For instance, Grandma sets up a trust for her grandchild. The money was Grandma's money. That can be a plain old support trust. It could be a spendthrift trust, or it can be a special needs trust. And they all have a number of things that are in common. For one thing, none of those trusts have to pay the state back for any Medi-Cal benefits received, at least not if they're properly drafted. Usually they are spendthrift trusts, meaning that the someone who the beneficiary owes money to cannot come after the trustee and sue the trustee to get something out of that trust. The only time anything that comes out of that trust can be attacked by a creditor would be after it is distributed to the individual. But a third-party trust in many regards is similar to a special needs trust and can be a third-party special needs trust. So that's the best I can do with that question.
Well, I think you did very well, but thank you. John, any further comments? Okay, here's another one. I mean, we've got people out there who's got these very complicated questions, and my guests are up to this, so don't worry. Again, 866-798-8255 if you do have a question, comment, etc. Here's the next one. Although advance directives are legal documents, they're often not enforceable. If the advance directive is not part of the medical record or not in plain view or easily accessible, the automatic default is to prolong the life of the patient, even if it goes against his or her stated wishes. John, comment on that, will you?
I agree with that. I saw a percentage a while ago that the majority of people who have healthcare directives, they never go enforced. They don't bring them along with them when they go on trips. You usually don't carry it with you when you're on a bike ride. So what happens when you go to the hospital? Of course, as the question states, doctors are just going to do their best. They're just going to make decisions, and sometimes they make decisions that would not have even been consented to by the patient. So what I do for my clients, there's a lot of different approaches to this, is there is a probate code section that says that upon admission to the hospital, the medical staff has a duty to try to contact the agent or to determine if there's a healthcare directive or immediate family members who can make decisions. And as part of that duty, the medical staff has to look through your personal effects. So you could include some sort of reference to where the directive could be found there. Better yet, I give my clients the ability to have an emergency contact card so that they can keep that in their wallet. There's a 24-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week service I line them up with where the medical staff can call a number, get a copy of their healthcare directive, and know the contact information of their emergency contacts. That solves that very important problem for them.
Peter, any comments from you on that?
Well, that was, it was a great answer. I mean, I use the little wallet cards that are on the yellow folder that the California Medical Association advanced directives come in. And what I do, I show clients my own. I pull it out when I'm doing their documents or doing the intake with them, and point out that this is the name of my significant other and my brother and my phone number, their phone numbers. And so after they take all my money and all my credit cards, maybe somebody will find the card and have the kindness to call somebody. And
you think there's some kindness left when it comes to money?
Well, my joke is that, you know, they might call one of my friends and who never bothers to answer her phone. And so, you know, several months later when they find my remains in the morgue somewhere, then they'll at least know who to contact to have my remains cremated.
Judge Hyman, please.
Let me just add that this is, all kidding aside, this is a real potential problem. I was hospitalized briefly a couple of months ago in a very good hospital, and I was not asked if I had a healthcare directive. I was not asked if I wanted to sign something in terms of a healthcare surrogate or anything like that. So you have to be proactive, is my sense. I mean, when I see doctors for in-office visits, I'm never asked. I'm never asked by them. I'm never asked by their staff. So I think the teaching point here for your listeners, Chuck, is that not only do you have to have one of these documents prepared, but you have to be proactive in terms of letting everyone know that you see professionally, medically, that you have one of these documents, and to get them a copy of it so they can put it in your chart.
Let me, again, to help all of you in case you're interested in learning more about this, and this is what Judge Hyman brought to my attention some months ago, which is the basis for us doing this program this evening. Harvard Medical School offers special reports on a whole bunch of different health topics. And if you are interested either in a rather comprehensive report entitled Advanced Care Planning Report, end quotes, the website for Harvard Medical School is www.health.harvard.edu. It also has something that I think you might find, and you can look at this. It's a 4-page document you can find on your computer if you go to that website. It's a Form 2. It's entitled Form 2 Health Decisions Worksheet. And it really gives you an opportunity to, on 4 different sheets, kind of outline what it is that you would like to do, both while living or what kind of care you would want, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's very important for you to have that. And again, I'd like you to be aware, if you want to listen to Joanne Marr's latest report, and it's Death Goes Public, although it was aired today on KALW earlier before my program, it will be available for you to listen to. And if you're interested, it's on the KALW website, www.kalw.org, or it's on Joanne's website, End of Life Radio, one word, endofliferadio.org. Bill, welcome to your legal rights.
Hello.
Hi.
You know, when I was calling, I was thinking more of my mother's conversation with me a couple of months before she passed unexpectedly. But, you know, you never know you know, if you're in an accident or anything else. And while these are not things that people want to talk about or think about, you know, I just realized that, you know, I have a brother-in-law who's in early Alzheimer's. And, you know, this way people can feel comfortable about making sure that it doesn't become 52 pickup. It's okay, this is what I wish, and I can, you know, this, and let the key people know about it, and that way, you know, whatever's gone on in life, that they can feel good about not leaving real questions or conflicts for those who have to deal with, mm-hmm. Whether it's end of life or decision making, and that way your wishes or the person's wishes are met.
So in other words, what I think you're saying, if I may, Bill, is that this, in consideration of your family members, your children, your, let's say, surviving spouse, etc., you really owe it to them to put together and execute an advanced care directive. Is that what you're essentially saying?
Well, that and an understanding that there may be conflicts, there may be things that you haven't taken into consideration, and this way it's there.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Thank you very much.
And the judge was right on for hawking you about having a program on this.
Well, I agree. Yeah, Judge Hyman has been a great friend of this program. He's been on the program a number of times, a great resource for me, and I feel very privileged to have his interest in continuing want to give me some direction. So, Bill, thank you very much for calling.
Thank you.
Bye. Take care. Peter, do you have anything to add to what Bill was talking about?
No, I don't think so, Chuck.
Okay.
It was
a
very interesting comment.
We've got Matt. Matt, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Oh, hi. How you doing?
Okay. How you doing, Matt?
I'm pretty well, thank you.
Good. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. My question is, excuse me, just in terms of the Advanced Health Care Directive and it being sufficient to cover a situation as mine. For instance, I've been living with my partner for 20 years, and we have a child together. We own a home in Oakland, and but we're not married. We've never done anything like that. We just, you know, it's just the way it's always been. And is it something that we should really think about, like getting married for legal reasons?
Hey, that's a good one. Okay, that's very good. So, in other words, you're wondering now, in terms of the consequences that
exactly.
We're now talking about here, would it be important for you and your partner, who are not married,
mm-hmm.
although you have had a child together, would it be important for you to get married? Is that what you're saying?
Would it be? Yeah, exactly. I mean,
yeah,
would it be,
all right.
Legally, because I know people have been in situations where, for instance, somebody suddenly falls ill and they're in the emergency room,
yeah.
and somebody shows up and they say, well, you're not really the spouse, you're not family.
So we're not going to let you in. Okay,
exactly.
very good point, Matt. Let me get some comments from you.
This
is Judge Hyman responding. Matt, turn your radio back up so you can listen. Will you, Judge Hyman?
Thank you. Well, that's why you have a health care directive. That's why you...
Even if you're not married.
Oh, it doesn't matter. My relatives are on the East Coast, and I have both them as well as local people available, listed, so that whoever they can get a hold of, they can get a hold of, and they can, you know, mm-hmm. I've discussed mm-hmm. what I want,
yeah.
plus the document. No, you don't get married just so that you can have a say in terms of how someone else is being medically treated. There's documents for that. It's their health care directive. there are documents that can take care of all of your situations, including estate planning and everything else. Look, I'm not trying to say do get married. I'm not trying to say don't get married. I'm just saying that you don't need to get married in order to have a say regarding your partner's medical care in the event that they become seriously injured and you need to intervene.
John, please.
Yes, I think I agree with Judge Hyman, and I would also add it makes it even more important that you do a health care directive right now because of what would happen if you didn't. So if there was a California Supreme Court case, Cobbs v. Grant, that says that a person's closest available relative can make health care decisions for them if you're incompetent, and that in the case they refer to a married person. And that's been expanded to include a person who's a domestic partner.
But that's a formal thing in California, to be a domestic partner.
Correct. So if you're not married or in a domestic partnership, you have no health care directive. You arrive at the hospital. You're unable to designate a surrogate. There's no conservator of the person. Then your closest available relative could initially start making health care decisions for you unless and until a conservator is appointed for you. And in fact, the order of priority may not give preference to your partner in order to have somebody appointed as conservator. So I would recommend immediately having a health care directive drawn up.
Matt, you mentioned that you and your partner have a home. You live in Oakland. I would suggest, since obviously you're going to be thinking about this, having listened to this program, why don't you contact the Alameda County Bar Association Lawyer Referral Service and at least give yourself the next step to trying to educate yourself about what you may do. They have a lawyer referral service. You can call them. I'll give you the number in just a moment. Have a half an hour consultation with an attorney who does estate planning, et cetera, just to start learning about this. So the area code there for the Alameda County Bar is 510-302-2222, 510-302-2222. And I want to, again, urge those of you, and please don't wait for another 5 or 10 minutes because the program, unfortunately, will be over. Our toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And again, something that I think you might find very practical, very easy, and kind of giving you a little experience about what some of the issues may be. There are a number of really good questions that the Harvard Medical School has put together on its Form 2, the Health Decisions Worksheet. And it's 4 pages, and you can look at this on your computer. If you go to the Harvard Medical School website, www.health.harvard.edu, and find Form 2, Health Decisions Worksheet, this is something that will help to open up your thoughts about, gee, this is what I can do, or this is what I'd like to do, et cetera, et cetera. And it's some way that you can begin to get involved in terms of what you want to do, perhaps before you even consider contacting an attorney. Peter, what else would you like to bring up before we end the program, which unfortunately is going too fast?
Well, simply to reiterate, I think the major points that we've made tonight, that having a health care power of attorney, designating an agent in advance to make these decisions for you, is really critical. It's something that when you get a chance to do your estate planning, you should make sure you do this. You don't have to do an estate plan at the time you do a health care power of attorney, but it's something that everyone should think about and get it done. It's a conversation that people often don't like to have. Roz Chast's book, Please Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant, the wonderful cartoon book by the New Yorker cartooner about cartoonists dealing with her family, her elderly parents, about making these decisions, is a wonderful introduction to the problems of getting your parents to sit down and talk about these things.
What's the title again, Peter?
Well, I'm not getting it 100% straight, Chuck. It's Please Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant?
I think I have seen that before. Yes,
it's a cartoon book.
Yes,
a beautiful cartoon book about her the last years of dealing with her parents and getting them to try to make these decisions.
Very good. That's another resource, everyone. If you Google the New Yorker, and isn't there something more pleasant we can talk about?
Yeah, just Google Roz Chast, C-H-A-S-T.
C-H-A-S-T. Okay, terrific. All right, let's see. Who's up next, Martin? We've got Angelo. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I'm calling because I'm kind of living the situation right now. And so I was recently in a situation where we were asked by the hospital to make some decisions for my father, and I'm saying that's a horrible position to be in for someone, and there's something called a PULSE.
Yes.
Physician's Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment, which I think is maybe a better document for people to think about, but maybe that's just for people who are closer to the end of life and not in a surprise situation.
We just talked about that a few minutes ago, Angela.
Oh, okay.
Yes. Yeah, maybe you missed
and
it.
And then the other thing I would say is once you have the PULSE, you really do need to manage it yourself. You can't expect the doctor to send it for you or the assisted living facility to send it to the hospital for you or anything like that. You need to get it to the hospital yourself.
Very good. Very good point.
Okay.
Very practical point. And
yep.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Are you working okay with your father at this point?
Well, we're quite frustrated.
Hmm.
He was intubated and he had a pulse, but it didn't get to the hospital.
Oh.
Right.
And there were problems, huh?
Right, that's...
Sorry to hear that. Sorry to hear that. Thank you very much for calling letting us know about that. I want to take another call or two. I want to remind those of you who do listen to the live program that, again, we are doing our monthly Call a Lawyer Night. We try to do this every month, usually the fourth Wednesday of the month. And we're doing it next Wednesday, which is June 28th, when at 7 p.m., California time, of course. This is when I have several attorneys here at the station, KLW Public Radio in San Francisco, three or maybe four certified specialists, whether it's workers' comp, whether it's estate planning, criminal law, family law, and then we have other attorneys, landlord-tenant, employment law, etc. And you can talk to an attorney off the air, no obligation whatsoever on your part, while I'm doing the live program with my guests on the air, the live call-in program. And if you're interested in Call a Lawyer Night, the number to call is 1-800-525-9917, 1-800-525-9917. And again, I want to... I've been a lawyer for a long time. I'm a consumer advocate, and I believe that people need to be proactive in terms of their own protection. And I think I'm not trying to find work for lawyers. Believe me, I am not. But I think it's important that people realize that if you have a problem, probably it makes, to begin with, a lot of sense of perhaps calling your local Bar Association Lawyer Referral Service and get a half-an-hour consultation. It's a great investment, $25 or $35. And that way you begin to understand what's going on. Also, there are a whole bunch of very fine books written focusing for laypersons published by NOLO, N-O-L-O Press. And I highly recommend that. You can find them in the consumer section of your local library if you're interested, or you can buy them at a bookstore. NOLO has a whole bunch of different publications. By the way, NOLO is not a funder of this program, but it provides a great service. All right, we have, we have Marilyn. Welcome to the program.
Hi. What if you don't have anybody to put on your advance directive?
Oh, that's a good point. You do not have someone, you don't even have a close friend?
I do have someone, but I'm thinking in the future I might not.
Well, now, okay, Judge Hyman's going to respond to this one.
Well, what happens if you're in a situation where there's truly no one that can help with respect to decision-making, then in the counties there is the public guardian, and the public guardian will be appointed to look after your medical needs as well as your financial situation. That's set up when a person truly has no one else, and they do a great job. My experience in Santa Clara County is they do terrific work, and if they need to go to court, they're represented by county counsel. Having said that, you're much better off having someone who knows you be involved in your life. But certainly it's a great deal of responsibility, and some people don't want to do it. But
let me throw this out, if I may. If you don't have someone, as Marilyn is saying, can you execute an advanced health care directive saying, I don't have anybody in mind for this, but if a public official is appointed by the court, I want this advanced health care directive to be controlling?
Absolutely. Judge Hyman. Absolutely.
Well, you can execute a health care directive without naming an agent.
Okay.
Absolutely.
There you go, Marilyn.
Absolutely.
Did you
hear that, dear?
Yes, thank you very much.
Okay, now, also, you can find health care directives if you Google California Medical Association Advanced Directive, the form, you can find the form. So, good luck to you, and thank you very much for calling. Our last caller is Rod. You have about maybe 1 minute max.
I keep health care directives in my refrigerator. I've been told that that's a good place for emergency people to look. In my car, glove compartment, and just in the file cabinet, and so on.
So you've got at least several copies of your health care directive.
Yes, and some friends have it also.
Good.
Recently, I had a good cause for that, and what I can tell you is that none of them were found initially. The police got from my address, tried to find neighbors, and one of my neighbors did get the health care directive. In fact, she was one of the people named to take over if I needed it, and all that worked out fine.
Well, that's good.
I think the moral of the story is distribute as much as possible, and even then, it doesn't necessarily.
Very good. Work. Very good point. Very good point, Rod. Thank you very much. So, in other words, you can have various copies, several copies of your advanced health care directive, and you want to get it around so various people know where it may be. We have just a short time left in the program. Peter, I'm going to give you the last 30 seconds. What do you have to say for yourself?
Well, just to emphasize how important it is for someone to sit down, talk to the lawyer, talk to the doctor when it comes to that about what is appropriate at the end of life. Also, be sure not to confuse certain things. For instance, some people think that if they don't want heroic means at the end of their life, then they should simply say, I don't want to be resuscitated. I want a DNR. Now, this could be a very healthy person who, you know, does not want heroic means at the end of life, but if you say, I don't want to be resuscitated, you could be walking down the street, have cardiac arrest. They say, well, this person doesn't want to be resuscitated, and you're dead.
But that doesn't sound good at all.
Appropriate resuscitation. We keep a defibrillator in my office for just such emergencies.
We have come to the end of the program. I want to thank you very much for joining us, gentlemen. You've been terrific. There's never enough time. That's the problem. Peter Stern and John Martin, specialists in estate planning, trust, and probate law, certified by the California Board of Legal Specialization. Thank you both very much. And, of course, always thank you, Judge Hyman, California Superior Court Judge Eugene Hyman, retired. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Great to have you here. Next time on Your Legal Rights, our topic is identity theft. Prevention and how to protect yourself from being a victim. My guest will be San Mateo County Deputy District Attorney Vishal Jangla. Let me spell your name for his name for you. Vishal, last name Jangla, a prosecutor of electronic crimes, including cyberstalking, computer hacking, and significant identity theft offenses. It's also our monthly Call a Lawyer Night for listeners to call in and speak with attorneys off the air at 1-800-525-9917. Your Legal Rights production staff members are program engineer Joanne Marr and production assistant Martin McClain. This segment of Your Legal Rights was made possible by the California Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar and by the National Board of Trial Advocacy, which also funds the public radio satellite transmission of the program for national distribution. I thank you for joining us on Your Legal Rights Public Radio, and I sure hope you join us next time on your public radio station. I'm Chuck Finney.